Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Nine minutes after nine on a Thursday, Mike McNamara, joined by Tim Lynch from McAllen, Texas. Timmy, how are you?
Hey, I'm just fine, Mac. How about yourself?
I'm well, thanks. And Will Costantini joins me from the suburbs of Kansas City. Will, how are you?
Great, Mac. Great day here in the Midwest.
Really? How's your gambling habit? Good? Keeping you healthy?
I did pretty well last night, so.
Do you consider it a gambling habit and therefore a vice, or do you consider it just some form of recreation?
Well, some people are gambling, but I'm not gambling, right?
So. You're taking, as Tim would say, you're taking other pensioners' money. And then the joining us from Southern California is Jeff Kenny. Jeff, how are you?
I'm good, Mac. How are you?
Hey, I'm well. When Bronze walks by, tell him, hey, Mac and everybody says, hey.
He's quarantined, man. He won't be walking by today.
Oh, shit. He always walked by. But anyway, all right.
Yeah, I know.
All right. We're going to talk about the Incheon landing. It had its end, Operation Chromite, as it's known, which is the call sign of what? First Marines, right? Chromite 6, RCT-1. And so let's talk about the Incheon landing. So, who's that? Okay, Jeff, what do you? And we'll go around the table once, and then we'll go from there. The most fascinating fact of the Incheon landing.
Well, to me, the most fascinating fact of it is how quickly they put it together, how challenging the objective was from an amphibious warfare standpoint, and how able they were, how effectively they're able to keep it, you know, a secret from the enemy. I thought all three of those things, based on the lead up to it, there's a lot of indications of pending disaster in regards to this operation, but it turned out good. Some people say it's like the only successful operation the United States pulled off militarily between the end of the war in 1945 and Desert Storm. So, I mean, so there's that about it, you know.
So just the speed and the operational security.
Yeah. And the amphibious skill of it. They had leftover guys, Admiral Struble, who had been on the D-Day landing and several other amphibious operations, to be able to negotiate the narrow channels that led into, you know, where they landed, the problem of the Wolmido Island, which kind of inflated the main landing area, the fact there was no beach, they had to climb up with ladders, but even more so, the difference in the tide between high tide and low tide in those inlets, and the fact that you really had to hit this thing dead on from a naval standpoint to make it work, to me was masterful.
Right. All right, Timmy, what your thought? Give me something about the Incheon landing that, you know, makes you shake your head.
Well, the fact that the Navy and Marine Corps team right up until the time they executed it was not what they wanted to do. They wanted to go into to Osan below Seoul, which was a much easier thing to do, and MacArthur wouldn't have it. He absolutely insisted this is what we're going to do, and like Jeff said, the speed with which they put this together, given the complexities of running 70,000 man invasion force, that couldn't have been done without our World War II experience, and nobody else could have done that at that time. Nobody else could do that today at all. I mean, we all know the complexities involved with an amphibious invasion against a contested shore, having exercised that repeatedly aboard naval shipping. And that is one complex evolution. And they hit the tides exactly on time. Never did that in World War II. It was amazing. It was amazing how well that they did. And then the speed with which they got off of the out of the waterfront and capturing key terrain. I mean, first day's objective in 20 minutes. they're throwing up there from that first hill. It's amazing. It's got to be one of our finest hours.
Will, how about you?
Yeah, I think that the audacity of the whole thing, and you know, just starting with the idea, but then it violates all kinds of what we consider doctrine, right?
Yeah.
No training. We had people that we hadn't sent to boot camp that were on those ships going over there. No real, all kinds of things that we think are required to be successful. They just stepped over in planning. And I think, I went to MacArthur, but I think in his head that the gamble, the surprise side of it was going to overcome a lot of deficiencies. And I think that's what happened and led to the success.
I've interviewed guys that have, that were part of that. And things I didn't know, right? And one of them was there were guys who got on ships who never went to recruit training.
Right.
I thought that, you know, that, okay, that even though they were green Marines, but there was all this experience and Will, I don't know if you know that, but that's you. Your connection's weak, evidently. So just so you know, that's that sonar sound that sounds like we're about to get sunk by some kind of torpedo. that's Will's system renegotiating. But anyway, they never went to recruit training. Paris Island, San Diego. Where did you? And that has to be a rough group, right? Where did you go to recruit training? On a ship en route to Incheon and then to Chosen. Oh shit! So everybody else is a candy ass compared to me. Don't tell me about San Diego, and sure as shit, don't tell me about Paris Island and Sam Fleas, for God's sake.
Yeah,
and so and then hold on. Let me finish that one more thought, and then one of the guys I meet is a tanker, right?
Yeah.
He was on tanks. They got new tanks at the pier when they loaded in San Diego. They got off to drive them in around a baseball stadium in Japan, and I don't know if it was Yokohama or one of the port cities, but they drove them. They drove them from the pier to this baseball stadium, and that's how they got proficient on these new tanks. So it might have been the M48 because they had Sherman, right, and they had Shermans, and I think they had the patent, and I can't remember.
M26, man.
Yeah, and so, but again, they never fired it in training, let alone in combat, and so that's how we went there, and that's, you know, when you think about that, that in and of itself is amazing. And then this discussion started the other night in a text message format, and I said, well, whose idea was this anyway? Where did this come from? Did it come from some OPT? And right, exactly, and. Go ahead, Jeff. You were going to make a comment, yeah. And then.
Well, actually, I was partaking of adult beverages, and watching TV, and it hit me, September 15th, something happened, and Incheon happened. So I sent the text, and truth is, it was MacArthur's his own, as I said, and later reiterated by Timmy, it was his own damn self, and I think it's. The you know, the genesis of that was he did all these land where they're not amphibious ops in the Southwest Pacific while we were hitting Tarawa and Saipan and Guam. And those are vital islands to take in order to move closer to be able to, you know, to threaten the Japanese homeland. But he even would say, he said, I went into the Philippines deliberately, you know, at the same time the Marines were going into Peleliu, knowing that the Japanese would focus, you know, on this telegraphed punch. And that was what we did. And we had to, because of the way the force design was in World War II. And I think he said, you know what? The Marines want to land at Kusan, big, nice beach, you know, or the Navy. They wouldn't even let the Marines Marine Command in on the first meetings of this thing. We weren't important enough, I guess. And but they wanted land because, you know, you could a good tidal approach to the thing, reasonable surf and everything like that, not too many obstacles, big broad beach, just where anybody would guess you would come. And MacArthur's like, you know, I'm not looking for another glorious, you know, Iwo Jima type thing here. I want to outflank these guys. And he did it. And, you know, the thing about that that's so amazing, though, about the Marine Corps, I mean, is you guys are absolutely right when you say a lot of those guys didn't go to boot camp. But I have to tell you, most of the guys who didn't go to boot camp who ended up fighting in that first year in Korea, particularly Chosin Reservoir, were guys who became the 7th Marines. The other guys, like 5th Marines was basically just 1-5 and the headquarters of 5th Marine Regiment. And they divided them up, like they took H&S and part of Alpha Company, that was 1st Battalion. And then the other companies ended up being 2nd and 3rd Battalion of the 5th Marines. And it never got, I don't think, above 2,000 guys until they actually went into to Wonsan, you know, at the beginning of the Chosin campaign some months later. And the 1st Marines were these guys who just either they just got a boot camp or they didn't get a chance to go, and they had to learn how to do side alignment and sight picture on the fantail of a heaving ship. And so, you know, it's like it was how they did it. And the same thing with the tanks. You know, the they had a lot of tanks. Like they had like 9 tanks land on Womido Island to support 3-5, which took that down. And, you know, they only had 14 casualties in that whole thing. And meanwhile, the Korean guy, they knew that the Marines were coming at a certain point. Probably by 13 September, the North Koreans knew that we were coming. Because of the approach, you had to wend your way through these, you know, through the narrow approaches to the actual city, the port city of Incheon. And, you know, there are some heroes that we had. There's this Navy lieutenant commander named Clark who took this island where he could see everything. And he was using locals who weren't appreciative of North Koreans coming, and they told him stuff. And this guy, the North Koreans got on junks, kind of like a sand pebbles type thing, and they attacked his little island. He sunk them personally. He mounted a machine gun on one of his little boats that was docked and sunk these junks with a machine gun. And it's an amazing story about how that worked out. And again, like I say, the amphibious expertise of guys who were thrown together. You had Colonel Puller was the 1st Marines. You had Lieutenant Colonel Ray Murray. He wasn't even a colonel. There's like 50 active duty colonels in the Marine Corps, probably 12 of them just sitting there on Hawaii, you know, and they used Murray, who had been the CO of 2nd Battalion 6th Marines, which is the inspiration for the book Battle Cry. Ray Murray was that battalion commander for Guadalcanal, Tarawa, and Saipan in the Second World War. And now here he is, the CO, regimental commander of the 5th Marines, all 1,930 of them or whatever it was.
Well, how is Chesty Puller still a regimental commander? I mean, he was
in Hawaii, right? And he volunteered. And they sent him back, and he's there in Camp Pendleton. You know, when the Marines started showing up, the 1st Marine Regiment did not exist in its form until, like, I'd say not 8 weeks before they did in China.
Wow.
They brought him out of mothballs, and they brought the 1st Marine Regiment out of mothballs. Because even though the glorious act of the National Security Act of 1947, which Victor Krulak likes to crow about so much as his own personal victory, him and his chowder club dudes. The truth of it is they didn't fund any of that stuff that they agreed on. So we basically had 2 reinforced battalions in the Marine Corps, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast. And the one on the West Coast was 3-6, and they're getting libo in the Med when they got told, hey, go through the Suez Canal, go through the Red Sea, head fucking east, and along the way, we're going to turn you into 3-7. And that's what they did with those guys. They didn't fight at Incheon, but they did fight in the Chosin campaign.
A little bit.
Incheon and then Seoul was 1st and 5th Marines mostly, yeah.
A little bit. Okay, here's a history quest before we continue our discussion. History question. How old was Douglas MacArthur when the Incheon landing happened?
138 years old.
No,
I mean, he was old. He was like in the 70s.
About 70, 73. Yeah.
He was 70 years old. Are you kidding me?
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, he graduated West Point like 1915.
Yeah, he's born 1412. Born in 1880. I mean, how crazy is
West
that?
Point. 1902.
Yeah, years of service, 1903. I'll tell you what, if you ever want an interesting book.
Mac?
Yeah, interesting book, though, American Caesar.
Yeah, it's a great book.
Yeah, MacArthur is a weird dude. He's a weird guy. But he's one of those guys in American history that he goes through this shit, and he never gets touched. Everybody around him gets whacked. He never gets touched, though. He's one of those guys, charmed guy. Go ahead, Timmy.
There's a small abandoned fort in New Mexico after you cross over the border from Texas where MacArthur's dad was stationed, and MacArthur spent about 3 years there learning how to ride horses and be a hard ass. But it was not a big outpost. It was one of many outposts that were dotting the Mexican border because of problems with Mexico. But he spent a lot of time there, and you can pull over, and they have big, you know, reproductions of the pictures of him sitting there as a child on the stoop of this damn house in the middle of the friggin' desert.
Where is Douglas MacArthur buried?
I don't know.
West Point.
The MacArthur Memorial is a memorial museum and a research center about the life of General Douglas MacArthur. It consists of three buildings on MacArthur Square in Norfolk, Virginia. That's where he's buried.
I'll be damned.
I didn't know that. I assumed West Point.
Because he retired and he just hung out in Manhattan, I thought.
After his speech where he said, old soldiers don't die, they just fade away. The old barracks hymn from my time in the Philippines. That's actually a pretty close rendition if you've ever heard the speech, boys. Just so you know. Other thoughts on the Incheon landing, Timmy?
Well, you lose on the first day, 20 killed, 174 wounded, most of those by Navy LST 50 cal gunners shooting into 2.5 at the very beginning of the invasion.
No
shit.
So
subtracting the blue on blue tragedy, that's why I said this might be one of our finest hours. I don't even think that I think most of us would agree that, you don't look upon Iwo Jima as being like a spectacular final hour, our finest hour because of the casualties. But this is one where you got the boys, you came ashore, you rested them out, got them on the run, and they stayed on the run right up until you got onto the outskirts of Seoul. And that's got to be sweet being in pursuit. You watch the tapes back then, and they've got entire platoons on the deck of tanks just rolling on down the road. That had to be something.
Yeah, that's crazy. Will, anything else from the Incheon landing that breaks squelch for you?
I don't think so. Just, you made the point. Could we, would we do it today? And it's hard to imagine that you would have leaders on both parts of the naval service that would calculate risk and take it like that. It's hard to believe.
Yeah, once we got to the ORM segment of this COA, I'm out.
You guys won't even cross the street from the White House.
Well, then it'd be like the heat laser. It'd be in the press later that someone thought it was a good idea that we do this. Who's that idiot?
Right. Right. I want to get to that. But before we get to the heat laser and Franz Geil, let me tell you, and Freddie told me that I can't tell it like Freddie does, but Paul Kennedy, his nickname when he was at the base school was Freddie. But Paul Kennedy allowed Franz Geil to shoot him with this acoustic weapon. And to hear him tell the story is absolutely hilarious. All right. It's kind of like Emmett Brown from Back to the Future meets the Marine Corps, and Paul Kennedy's like Emmett Brown's dog. And so, what, Einstein? Yeah, not so Einstein. But anyway, before we get to that, today is the anniversary of the bloodiest day in military history in the United States, the Battle of Sharpsburg, if you're from the South, or the Battle of Antietam, if you're from the North. Have you ever been to the battlefield? Tim, I think you went. Were you on the one that Jay Lubos was there with us?
Oh yeah, yeah. I was on that one, and remember, we all had to have a battlefield. We took our lieutenant mentor groups to,
right.
And I was the Antietam guy. Me and Jeff Rowe and brother Paul Kennedy. We were the Antietam guys. I went there what 4 times a year. I love that mm-hmm. place.
Yeah,
me too.
Yeah. Do you have a give me something that you find fascinating about Antietam?
That my great-great-grandfather survived that charge on a cornfield. He was in the 17th Pennsylvania Bucktails. He must have been AWOL or something because they got slacked. And it's just hard to – but when you look at the very beginning, just for the listeners, Antietam lines up, if you're looking at it from the southern perspective, looking out towards the northern lines, starting at your left, it rolls. In morning, it starts with pressure on the left, then pressure in the center, then pressure on the right. And the Union gets repulsed, although they inflict some horrendous casualties on the Confederates that the Confederates can't take. But at the very beginning of that thing, there's a wheat field, and that doggone thing's not but a football, two fields in width, and maybe a 3 football fields in length. And inside that wheat field, we hemorrhaged more people, lives lost to goddamn Stonewall Jackson and the Sons of Treason. Than at any other 20 minutes in American history. It was a carnal house of unions trying to mass and drive off the withering fire of the Confederates, who were pretty damn game that day. But it's a great study of some shitty decision making by some pretty marginal generals, and Lee, quite frankly, is just lucky. He's just plain lucky.
It's amazing. Just 2 quick comments, and then we'll go to Will. But one, and I said this earlier, but rifling had changed combat, but the tactics had not evolved. The way they moved into, and as a result, and it wouldn't change until Spotsylvania. So that's one thing that you see at Antietam. The other thing is. Think about this. It's September of 1862. By July 1st of 1863, the Army of the Potomac undergoes this incredible transformation so that when they go back in what would be 10 months later, when they go back to fight in Pennsylvania, they have first string guys that are up to it at every major place. And it's incredible, as Tim said, when you go through the decision making at Antietam, you're just like, these guys are amateurs getting thousands of people killed. It's horrible. And then you see the performance of the Army of the Potomac and for that, you know, the leaders of the Army of the Potomac get some credit. And what was the guy's name in DC? Halleck, that dude?
Yeah, he
deserves some credit too, because they finally get the first string there and they throw out the cronies and the politicians and things like that. So I think that's interesting. Will, go ahead, Tim.
I just wanted to remind the listeners that we had his plans. Lee's invasion plans were recovered in Frederick, Maryland, because he was rampaging along the Maryland border and had to buy time to consolidate his forces to defend himself. But McClellan had his plans. If he had pressed through South Mountain, he would have dismantled them. But he didn't because he was slow.
Order 133.
He's a exactly wrapped around 3 cigars.
3 cigars.
The
3 doobies.
Will, thoughts on Antietam?
Yeah, I've only been there one time, I think, and.
We're having
to understand, looking at a map and looking at the ground. And Antietam is a mess, and part of it is because the people were a mess there. And it is hard to believe. When you look at the size of the place, it's really hard to believe how many people got killed there in such a small spot.
Yeah. What is it? Hell in a very small place? Interesting.
The MVM food.
Yeah. Jeff. Thoughts on Antietam, since you were Tim's assistant there?
Yeah, we went a million times, it seemed like. It was always great. I always learned something new. But to me, the most impressive act there was A.P. Hill reinforcing from from Harper's Ferry, and they basically humped their ass off all day, you know, like 20 miles, I think it is. And they smashed into the Yankees. They're trying to cross Burnside's Bridge, and that's culminated the Union's efforts for that day. And, you know, the classic lesson of the whole thing is interior lines in the defense and mobility in the defense laterally, you know, and to fend off the attacks. But the campaign leading up to Antietam was pretty – General Allen, remember that thing was like 3 days long where he went to South Mountain and, you know, it was pretty brutal, really. Right. But, you know, the campaign led up to it was pretty interesting. But when they finally got down to Antietam, to me, the main thing was A.P. Hill with his red shirt, you know, coming flying up that road there, you know, and smashing into the Federals' right flank there. And I thought that was right movement, as Timmy says, you know, and drive him right back across the creek. So you know, and we did go there every time, and it was always good because it's a one day battle, and it's easy for people who weren't into it to really understand. You know, you had the cornfield, you had the sunken road, you had Burnside's Bridge. And, you know, there are clear lessons you could do. So from a tactics instruction standpoint, it was very efficient, you know, to do that. You know, that's why
Sharpsburg is a nice town for young lieutenants.
Yes. The Shepherdstown Dick Festival, as we called it, was their reward for being good students afterwards. You take them across the river to West Virginia, girls college there.
You know, we when we did that thing with Jay Luvas, I was talking about him a little bit earlier, but Luvas argued, and I'm reading this, that the primary value of the subject of history to a military officer is not just the facts, but also a grasp of trends and the meaning of ideas. History should not be subjected to the idea that it repeats itself, an unreasonable process that forces historical evidence into convenient patterns. Rather, the study of history, military history in particular, helps to illustrate points of leadership and doctrine. And so, to me, Luvas was a pioneer in this stuff. I mean, when before the day of, you know, download the app and then pay for the tour with video and audio and all that, you know, Luvas and his little green books, when you went to the battlefield, you bought those and you wore that shit out. And then your education progressed to, you know, to the sources of his information, where you got broader and deeper stuff from those and a deeper understanding. But so to me, he's an interesting, very interesting guy. The other thing about Antietam is, you know, to me, I always find it amusing, Robert E. Lee, you know, he's a stately white-haired dude, right? But the way he bets on the Army of Northern Virginia, right, he's got the Potomac River behind him. He's got both flanks pinned to it. And he's got, I think, one and a half fording sites behind him. If he loses here, it's over. The Army of Northern Virginia will get destroyed that day. And But he knows there's no fucking way that that's happening. And so it's interesting, his stately manner. What's his horse, Traveler? Something like that?
Yeah, right.
He is a shit talking. He bets everything on his guys, and he knows he's. So it's interesting. He's kind of like the University of Miami in his head, in this side of this stately, regal gentleman of the South. And but as a general, and he's not wrong very often. But it's interesting that day because, you know, he essentially gambles the entire Army of Northern Virginia at that fight because he doesn't have to fight there. And he decides he's going to. So I think it's a pretty pretty interesting little fight. Now, I was talking about – go ahead.
Interesting thing about Luvas? Because he showed up with another colonel, and I want the audience to know, he's the author of the Army War College Guide to Antietam, Gettysburg, several battlefields. So, and these guides have maps, and they're very, very good. And so he's the author of that. So he comes down, starts tracing through the battle. Then he looks at us. He goes, "You guys know this already, right?" We say, "Yeah, we do." He goes, "Let's go start talking decision making." And then he goes to where Burnside was in that house, and he starts talking about this Mensa group he's part of, where they've got to research something that has nothing to do with their profession, and they had labeled him with ghosts and that kind of phenomenon. And he told a story about some woman being up there in the second floor. If you guys got to remember this, because if not, I've made it up somehow.
No, I remember it.
Yeah, the woman that was in the second floor window when there wasn't even a floor in the house because they were rebuilding it. And he went on and on and talked for about a half hour about the stuff that he's uncovered, because he goes, personally, I don't think I have the sensitivity to perceive any of this stuff, because I've always thought it was nonsense. And I remember thinking, this is the most damn interesting day we're going to have with a professional. Because then he went back into talking detailed decision making, and he even had an explanation for the Burnside's Bridge, the troops trying to force a bridge when they could have waded across the stream without getting their waist wet. Which I can't remember what it was, but it seemed to make sense. Yeah, it was a fascinating time. We were very lucky to have those kind of opportunities.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, he was an expert on Frederick the Great. That was his original claim to fame. And I'll tell you what, he came and talked to the basic school. We had him talk one evening right there in the chow hall. We had the graduation breakfast. But it wasn't a breakfast. It was he talked about Frederick the Great, and then he I think it was kind of like a – extension of what Mac was saying about what he said about, trying to force, history repeating itself and stuff like that. And he kind of contrasted Frederick the Great with, in the battles he fought with the Civil War. He's a fascinating guy for that. He was really into his craft for sure.
No, it was cool. And cause we were all like that. We would read and read and read just so that when we went to these things, we could jam some kind of nitinoid fact up somebody else's ass. Oh yes, Jeff, but you're wrong about that. It's a popular misconception. Yes, and then you're like, but it was just, we were all up, and we're still doing it all these years later, and so, which is fun. The other thing that I find interesting about Antietam is that Lincoln declares victory and uses it as the basis, because he's all over McClellan's ass. Win something or tie something so I can issue this Emancipation Proclamation, which elevates the cause of the war, right, to a war about slavery, which will keep the Brits out of it, okay, because that's what I need to do, because I can't have the Brits and their textile industry siding with the South, okay? And so to me, the politics of it, and that's what happens. The Emancipation Proclamation issued on January 1, 1863. This is, the last battle of the fall. And then they go into winter camp. And then when they come out of winter camps.
Fredericksburg.
And then Gettysburg.
Well, then Chancellorsville in between, yeah.
And so we were talking about, I mentioned Franz Guile when I was talking about this headline, this heat gun, right? And you see it and you're like, what the fuck? A heat gun. And so I'm thinking, so somebody says, hey, we got this heat gun. And then somebody goes on TV and says, yeah, maybe think about using a heat gun. And it's some idiot comment in an OPT. So then I start reading it and it's this acoustic device, right? Why we're calling it a heat gun, I'm not exactly sure. Right, but we do, and it brought back the story of Franz Guile, Captain Franz Guile at the time, using this thing on Paul Kennedy, and then Kennedy's telling me about it. He goes, "Buddy, you need to see this." I'm like, "Dude, I'm not going anywhere near that son of a bitch." Okay, he goes. I said, "Did it literally?" He goes, "Oh yeah, it knocked me right to my knees." I'm like, "You're stupid, man. Why would you let him do that to you?" And so Will says he's got a fairly interesting – but again, Franz Guile's claim to fame, though, was that we were doing day patrolling, and he low-crawled through somebody else had taken a dump someplace in the training area. Franz low-crawled through it. And then he got on the phone – he got on the radio to tell, hey, somebody needs to come get me, and somebody needs to replace me because I'm covered in human excrement. But he wasn't smart enough to say – I'm throwing up blood, right? Yeah. I need to go. I got to go right now, right? He wasn't smart enough to do that. So he tells the truth over TAC-1, and we're all listening. Like, What?
Oh, man.
You get on the board for that one, man.
He did.
Yeah.
He was nominated for AI of the Month, and he was given the nickname, his call sign was Turd at the basic school.
Instant AI of the Month.
Because of it, I won't say his name. Another great call sign was, well, I will say it because he's still alive, and we're friends on Facebook. Colonel Fawcett shows up at the basic school.
Yeah, Steamer 6. Yeah.
He comes out one night to check on.
I was thinking maybe that was him he crawled through when you were talking. I was thinking about Colonel Fawcett when you said that.
No, but he comes out to watch training one night while we're doing something, and he goes to take a dump, and people got NVGs, and he doesn't cover and conceal himself very well, and they're watching him, and they're seeing the steam because it's so cold. And so from that day forward, he was Steamer 6. And then he shows up someplace, and he hears somebody say, "Where's Steamer 6? And he looks, I can't remember who, and says, "Who's Steamer 6? And like, "I don't know, sir."
Not you, that's for me, sir.
those idiots are just talking on the radio again. But anyway, Will has a story about Franz Geil.
So I joined 2-6 in the summer of 94, and Franz had been the CEO of Weapons Company and actually got replaced by Todd Horney, and the battalion had been deployed down to deal with the Haitian migration, some sort of liaison officer with the headquarters down there. And then so we deployed down to deal with the Cuban migration. So we were at Gitmo in August, September of 94. And we took in 40, 50, 60,000 migrants. I don't even know how many it was. And at one point, they rioted, broke out of the camps. We sort of stuffed them back into these triple-strand concertina wire camps. But there was a lot of bad actors. You know, Castro would open the jails again. There were hard criminals. There was organized crime. And we thought there might have been Cuban intelligence in there as well. And so we had guard towers around these camps, and there was a lot of innocent people that we were trying to protect as well. We just tried to jump in the water and get to Miami. And we found groups of young men congregating on the camps, and they were surveilling the guard posts. And so the idea from Franz is he took this mixing bowl that was probably 3 feet in diameter. And we took, you know, the cardboard roll side of a paper towel. And so he painted two of those black and duct taped them to the inside of this bowl. And then we had this pair of.
Wait, Will's internet's fucked up today.
Yeah, that's a great story. I heard that.
Hold on. Your internet's fucked up,
Will. I can hear you perfectly.
I know. You can hear us. We can't hear you, though. So he duct taped these two paper towel rolls into this black bowl?
It's a big silver bowl.
Okay.
We painted those two things black, so now they're on the inside. And somehow he got this old pair of huge headphones. So a Marine's wearing these headphones with a notepad, and another guy is taking this bowl with these things in it and directing it at the groups of people like we're listening to them. And they would disperse away from the wire when we would point this thing at them. It was absolute hilarity.
Yeah, genius, man.
And you know what his call sign was in 2-6?
I'm afraid to ask. What?
The lieutenants called him the toy.
Wait, the what?
The toy maker. Because he was constantly doing that heat wave goofy stuff on and on. That's
he was a smart, so, you know, the toy Franz maker. Was on embassy duty the same time as me in Germany.
Were you guys friends?
I was in Frankfurt, and he was in, I want to say Munich. He was in because there's consulates that we had Marines in all over Germany. Hamburg.
Well, and Franz is a German speaker, unlike Jeff, who speaks alcohol.
I don't say much in German, but what I say perfectly. And
no, but you have one phrase. What's your German phrase?
Bazooka Wiesem? Ende der Halle links. Handtasche aufmachen, bitte. Before Sie rangen, Handtasche aufmachen. And basically that means, visitor's visa. Go down to the hall, take a left, window number 7. Before you go, open your handbag, please. And I also know, wo ist der Bahnhof? That means, where's the train station?
There you go. There you go. The so Franz is kind
Franz
of this...
Franz, he's really, he knew German, and he remembers me. I don't remember him because people remember us in Frankfurt because they all had to come through Frankfurt. That's where the big airport was, you know, and so that's where the company headquarters was. But Franz, and remember he used to make, Franz, like, if you're like waiting for lieutenants to do something, I was weapons company or weapons platoon commander, and I'm with him one time, and he's drawn circles. He's got a notebook. He's drawn circles. He wanted to see if he could draw a perfect circle. So it makes you wonder about, you know, and then you juxtapose that about all like the stuff Will just said about the whiz bang piece of technology there. You know, definitely a unique guy and smart.
Well, he was,
and funny though.
Yeah. He was smarter than the rest of us, like, and he would, you know, and he spoke German, and he was, you know, and he shows up with us idiots, right? And you know, we found him fascinating. He later gets into it with General Kelly, right? He calls out General Kelly, I think. What is Franz's?
I think it was Mattis on the MRAP.
On the MRAP, yeah. So if you've heard the name Franz Geil, that's probably how you've heard of it. We have other much more interesting stories than that.
And Franz invented something for the Rigid Raider to mount crew serves on, you know, when he was a lieutenant. He was a boat company guy, I think, for a Mew on the West Coast.
Yeah, he's like Emmett Brown from Back to the Future of the Marine Corps at that time. He's like, it's constantly.
Yeah, the MRAP thing is a bad story.
Yeah.
You know, it really is.
I don't know that much about it. I want to ask you, though, Tim and I had a discussion at 5 a.m. Pacific time and today, and I want to ask you guys about it. I interviewed my friend, my roommate, twice. His name's Tim. And Tim was raped twice in his life.
Three times,
I'm sorry. Yeah. And Al is a young, either in before he joined the Marine Corps, drugged and raped, and then in the Marine Corps twice as a junior enlisted Marine. And So Tim and I were talking, and the third commandment is trauma is trauma is trauma. And so the way trauma impacts us, it doesn't matter your nation of origin. It matters that you understand that it impacts us all the same way. But so I've had this thing in my head, though, and yesterday listening to him talk about that. And I'm going to read you an email from somebody who said this. Tim's interview was uncomfortable to listen to. I'm ashamed to even say that. I cannot imagine how I felt letting it out of the dark place he had buried it for so long. I pray Tim found relief in telling us. He will be better for it. But so there's an element of trauma that I want you guys to talk about, and just give me your thoughts. One is the element of shame, like, okay, you know. Mac, you tell the story about seeing somebody decapitated. You tell the story of the murder of your nephews. Another one of your sisters freezing to death. Blah, 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 blah. But none of that causes you shame. It might cause you sadness, but none of it causes you shame. And then you're not – the other part of it is guilt. You didn't precipitate any of those events, so you don't live with the guilt. And so when you say trauma is trauma is trauma, understand that. And then you say you've got to talk about your shit. If you have the shame that my friend had, or if you feel guilt that was my fault, you're not in the same box as the rest of us. You're in like three floors down in that box. So, Timmy, you and I were talking about this at 5 o'clock in the morning. So you first, give me your thoughts on that. And I think kind of a more nuanced and maybe mature understanding of what it is to be traumatized, and that it impacts us the same way in terms of scarring, but our response to it, I think a lot of times differs whether we are ashamed of what happened to us, because, you know, PTSD from combat is okay. PTSD from being raped, if you're a guy, is not okay. And I think that's what the email connotes. So your thoughts on that, Tim?
Yeah, first off, I want to echo the fact that it was uncomfortable to listen to, and I felt like it was a duty to listen to the whole thing, of course. And I remember in 87, a gunnery sergeant being tried for forced sodomy, and he was apparently a monster. And I remember Pete DeBreeze talking about it. God, apparently was huge. And I always thought that would be the biggest nightmare in the world, to be you know, unable to defend yourself against a predator like that. That's a nightmare. And so what the difference that we were talking about this morning, though, and this is interesting, because what Tim was harboring was guilt and shame for having been victimized not once but three times in similar matters. None of this were precipitated by him. None of us were necessarily his fault, right? And then this Tim here, who's dealing with depression in identical manner as the other Tim, identical manner, probably not drinking as much, but with the womanizing and stuff, almost identical.
Wait. When you say this Tim here, who do you mean?
About me. I'm talking about myself.
Okay.
I'm talking about myself. That the depression and whatnot, the shame that I had was not measuring up to. It was because it was because I bought this upon myself. This was all my fault. I mean, these are decisions I made that I knew at the time were sketchy, and I didn't have the discipline not to make them. So what I'm saying is you've got trauma, but then you've got trauma in which embedded in it is guilt and shame, and letting that guilt and shame out is difficult in Tim's case. And in my case, this Tim, it's difficult because out of pride, because both of us don't want any of you guys to know that we are this fucked up, that this has happened to us, regardless of our level of blame for each of these incidents happening. And I think Tim's case is the absolute worst, because it's very difficult to talk about and to hear about. But as you pointed out to him in the interview, you wouldn't believe how much of that shit's going around, the sexual violence and whatnot. And I guess in some respect, we're all a little bit lucky in that we haven't had to deal with this kind of stuff. But I thought that was interesting what we were talking about today, because if there's a hurdle of guilt, personal guilt associated with this trauma, that's a different entry ramp. You've got to first, particularly if you're in a case like mine, you've got to fess up to your complicity and say, yeah, I'm in a shit situation, but this is my fault. This is decisions I made. And that's the first thing I believe that you have to do, but I don't, it's got to be insurmountable when the shame that you're hiding doesn't necessarily belong on you. You're the victim in this goddamn thing. And I know what he's thinking, because my second wife was very physically abusive too. He's like, I'm a big fucking dude. How can this happen to me? I had a black eye once from her. That's the same thing that – what am I going to do? Tell you people that my wife is physically abusive? She weighs 90 pounds, you know? But I know exactly that kind of guilt. And it's a very, very difficult thing to admit to that, because in order to get onto the right pathway – you've got to let that all hang out, and that's very, very difficult. He's a brave man.
Well, you know, when I heard him, I was thinking I was still in Sharpsburg there for a second. When I heard him, I hear you, Timmy. In that, and I remember, because what I said to him is, you've been so afraid of everybody's response to, if you told them the truth, what's their response been like? And he said, oh my God, it's been nothing but love and sadness, that I dealt with this on my own for all these years. It's 180 degrees out of what I expected. And he's like, it's been unbelievable. And so to me, that's, you know, we live in this place, but again, I think like many other elements of post-traumatic winning, if you don't hear normal people talking about this shit, You think you're the freak, and you think you're this anomaly, and nobody can understand this. And then somebody looks at you and says, no, 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 let me tell you what's going to happen. When you tell everybody, this is what's going to happen. The exact opposite that you think. I mean, the people that love you. And I had this kid, a Lance Corporal, in 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines, who I told the story before, but I did post-traumatic wounding out at Camp Wilson. I'm standing up on the tables, right, as the stage, and there's 1,200 Marines, 1,100 Marines in there. And everybody leaves at the end of it. And I don't know if you know Gabe Diana, but he's a battalion commander. And one Marine comes back and tells me that he's been sexually abused by somebody in his family for years. And then if he ever talked about it, they'd make it worse. And so I check in on my tribal people, right? And so I'm going to text somebody. It might have been one of you guys. And I'm scrolling through looking for it. And I see his name. And so I just hit it. And I'm like, yo, motherfucker, what's up? You know? And he's like, Mac, how's it going? And I'm like, good, man. How's life? He goes, hey, I told my family. And I like, then I hit the call button. I said, you told your family? No shit. I said, man, that's some big balls. And he said, yeah, over Christmas I did. I said, what happened? And he said, oh, it was pretty emotional, but it was just so wonderful. And I want you to know, I would have never done that if I hadn't met you and hadn't started talking about it. So I just wanted to thank you because my life is so much different now than it used to be. And so my point is, like, going to therapy and all that was one thing. Hearing normal people talk about it, about shame and about guilt, is different. I think it drags a carcass out in the open, for what it's worth. Will?
Yeah, two things about guilt. They're sort of combat related. In 1st LAR, we lost 11 Marines over the total time I was in command there. And organic within the battalion at the time, we lost 4 Marines killed in action and 1 died in an accident. There was one Silver Star recipient. And
okay, hold on, hold
classic
on.
Combat stress.
Hold on, you cut out. So you said we lost 4 Marines, 3 in combat, 1 in a vehicle accident.
No, 4 Marines, yeah. 4 Marines killed in action and 1 in an accident. And the 4 killed in action, there was one officer who was a platoon commander for all 4 of those. And in the second incident, he basically went blank, had a classic combat stress reaction. And it was his sense of responsibility that he couldn't prevent these things from happening.
Right.
And for the men that we lost, I wish they were all back. But the one that haunts me is the vehicle accident. This Marine, we needed to get a part moved from Al Asad to Al Qaim. He grabbed it, got on a convoy. The convoy is run by a CSS unit. They didn't have trained machine gunners. He was a trained heavy, even though he was a logistics guy, got up. And due to some really poor leadership, bad decision making, and ill discipline in that convoy, they rolled the vehicle and killed him. And that one bothered. They all bother me, but that one bothers me now because I knew those convoys were ill disciplined and unsafe. And I guess it's trauma. It doesn't drive me over the edge, but every other one, the enemy gets a vote. There's nothing you can do about it. But that one, it's just so horrible to me. And if I feel guilty about anything that I did, I feel guilty in not figuring out that I shouldn't have let my Marines on those convoys. I knew it. And for some reason I waited to get hit by a baseball bat, and that one made me sick to my stomach and really question myself for you know, a lot of nights for sure. And again, I think about it. So guilt is very powerful, much more than any of the, you know, traumatic stuff, things getting blown up, bodies being blown apart, that kind of stuff. I don't know. It just didn't seem to impact me. But that one, that guilt as a CO, and I saw that guilt as a platoon commander really having an unbelievable effect on a phenomenal officer.
No, again, I've had these things rolling around in my head because I've met different people who have various degrees of culpability in the traumatic event that happened. And so they're in a tougher place. And then what do you say to them to get them on that path to transform their own life and other people's lives? What do you say to them? And I'd be curious and Jeff, you have the floor in a second, but as Tim and I were talking this morning, the shame that you feel if you were a victim because you were raped, because that's not an acceptable trauma, right? To me, it's like, let me tell you what's waiting for you once you tell the people that care about you. Their love and acceptance is what's waiting for you. Don't isolate yourself about it. I know that for a fact. The guilt thing is a harder thing. And to me, what works in post-traumatic winning is the truth. The truth works and is so powerful. In fact, I did an interview yesterday with the National Museum of the Marine Corps docents, which are kind of assistant tour guides or something like that. And so there's a whole bunch of them, and I'm on talking to them, and I told them, I said, post-traumatic winning belongs in the museum, man. This is our culture. This is one of the best parts of our culture, and I need to have an office in that son of a bitch, and you need to go start showing this shit. So it was awesome, but you know, one of the things that somebody said to me is that, hey, I really like what one of the things I saw you quoted as, and I'm like, oh shit. I said, what was it? And they're like, the truth lands with a thud and it needs no salesman. I said, that's straight up true. And it comes from listening to an interview with Jack Riley that thing popped into my head for whatever reason. And so to me, with people who share guilt, you know, the truth is what keeps them engaged with you. And that is, look, I can't offer you any rescue from that which you feel guilty. If you want me to piss down your back and tell you it's raining, I won't do that. But I will tell you this, there is only one path, and that is devote yourself to whatever task that honors that memory and makes that right in whatever way you can do it. And to me, the only path is post-traumatic winning, and it's a path of selflessly devoting yourself to something and to giving of yourself, and in that way, that's as good as you can do. And so I'd be curious about your thoughts on that too after Jeff goes. So Jeff?
Well,
shame and guilt.
Like so much what we talk about when we get to this type of subject, the first thing I feel is lucky that I didn't. There's like three types of stuff we're talking about here. The trauma of being a victim of a physical assault and feeling guilty because, especially in the case of this guy, Tim, where it's a sexual and violent assault, and he feels guilty because he feels that he somehow didn't resist enough or he wasn't effective at being able to defend himself, and he feels guilty as a man. And then there's the guilt of where you did an act of omission, of commission, where you actually did something despicable to somebody else. And in post-traumatic winning, that's like the guy, the melee soldier, who later lost his son and then committed suicide eventually. And there's that. So I feel guilty because, or not guilty, but lucky because I don't have that personal memory of those things that bad. I feel ashamed of some of the things I've done, but none of them approach a felony or anything like that. But then there's the guilt over decisions you made in the war. And that one is that's one that I can relate to, because when I get out there as an advisor, the thing that came home to me from my first time in Iraq to the second one was that the only way you can call this thing a win is if the Iraqis do it for themselves, and then later the Afghans. And the only way to get them to do it for themselves, and they were like half trained, the first guys who showed up there, if even half trained, was to get them out in the roads and have them soaking up some of the IDs that like Will's guys were getting out there at Al-Qaim area, you know, near the border, and other guys that, Dave Furness's guys there in Karma, Freddie's guys in Ramadi, to get these motherfuckers who let this shit happen to do it. But the only way you could do that was to get out there with them. And so I pushed my fellow advisor. I was a senior guy, and I had three teams underneath my team, and I pushed them. And I mean, I was kind of an asshole about it sometimes. And we lost guys. And then up here in ATB, one of the subsequent guys who ran this thing, he got these little plaques made, everybody who had been killed. And right outside where my little office is, there's like six of them, guys who got killed, who were part of the group that I had. And so that every day I look at them, you know, and I think to myself, but we needed to do it. But, you know, I just felt bad, you know, because ultimately, what's the point? I mean, we had this big, I guess, victory where, you know, the after we did the surge in 2007, 2008, and then ISIS just walked right across Anbar province, and the whole thing was for nothing. And now we're, you know, in some kind of, you know, mid-level stage. But I think I pushed it. I mean, I almost got killed myself pushing it. But the irony is I thought it would help the Iraqis ultimately. And that was our job, right? And the most ironic part of the whole thing is the day I got wounded, I had the XO of the brigade with me to protect him, because they had gotten Humvees, but they had no ECMs, and we did. And so I had him with me, and it didn't fucking matter. He was dismembered by the IED that went off right underneath him, you know, right behind me. And, so that type of thing I think about. And, there's a deeper thing, too. It's like the confession of bad feeling. Sometimes, like... And my kids will talk to me and they'll ask me about it. And I'm thinking to myself, am I going to do this kid any favors by telling him some of the anguish I got about things? Or will I just spread it? You know? So it's not something I got to answer to, but it's something that I think about.
All right. Go ahead. Tim, you next. Thoughts on any of that? You have to mute yourself, bro.
I cannot believe I just did that again. Holy shit, man.
It wouldn't be a broadcast without that.
It sure seems that way, doesn't it? No, my only thought about this entire discussion is my frustration in that I think that we know there's a good solution to start proactively addressing this ahead of the crisis point in most people's lives, seeing how we get Marines so young, and we're not for some reason able to take advantage of it. And that in and of itself is frustrating, because the mere fact that you've had me talk about something I never wanted to talk about with anybody on the air, and I got to think that the other Tim was most definitely in the same boat. The mere fact that we're even having this conversation is something. I mean, who would have thought this like 2 years ago when I would come on and talk about the news with you? Okay. Never even had any idea we were going to go this way. And I think it's healthy, and I think more people should do it. And I'm just excited, and I appreciate being able to be part of this conversation, because this is important, and everybody needs to hear it, because it's not just combat decision-related guilt. It's decision-related guilt in life, too. There's plenty of us that have more than enough of that to carry around.
Right. No. Will?
I mean, on the whole topic, I got to give credit to John Allen for just sort of starting to explore combat-related stress reaction, which expanded my knowledge and interest, and probably made me a lot more introspective about things. And I think the way Jeff broke it down, you know, being a victim and what you carry with that, then being a perpetrator, maybe what you carry with that, and then being a decision maker, it's it's likely three levels, but it all breaks the sort of the line of trauma. And which is worse, who knows? You know, does it affect people differently? Likely. But that's all part of sort of the human condition. And the awareness that it's out, and the awareness on how to deal with it in the force. You know, we shouldn't be where we are in the active duty force now. We should be light years ahead of where we are, because we know things that, you know, you're trying to, in your own nickel dime way, trying to jam it up their ass. But we should be better than we are out there.
I think we'll get there. It's just the growing pains of doing this. And when I told him yesterday, hey, post-traumatic winning belongs in the museum. I said, let me envision this. Maybe it's a little kiosk, or maybe it's in a little, you know, 60-second movie before that big movie plays in the big new theater, right? Hey, first a word about, you know, about living with trauma. And you have all these cuts of Marines, Marine moms and spouses, and this, you know, that paint this really quick mosaic, and you're like, all from our culture. This is one of the coolest pieces of our culture. Yet we ignore it. A lot of people ignore it, but they won't be able to for forever. And at some point, it will get the viewing it deserves. And I will tell you this: to me, and Tim and I were talking about this. To me, there's the knowledge piece of it, which is a class. To me, there's a leadership piece. About how you institutionalize this, how do you embrace this as a command, and so that we get our young leaders, lieutenants and sergeants, to leadership 301 and 401, as opposed to, you know, 101 and 201. We need them to be better. How do we get them there? And then there's the third piece of this is how we relate to the medical communities, and I've gone like almost 180 on this, from looking at the mental health community and saying, you know, you guys are failing, look at the numbers, to saying, you know what, we step back, we outsourced everything to you, we assume you're taking care of it. Well, guess what? We're the key element in the whole thing, right? It's us having these conversations with each other that is the most important. And if we'll do that, then we enable them. And then the other piece of that is understanding the truth about therapy and all this other shit that when people struggle, is that the two primary treatment protocols that get used by the DOD and the VA don't help between half and two-thirds of the people. So if you know that, guess what you do? You keep your finger on them. Hey, Tim, you know, how's everything going? I know you're going to mental health. I have other people that are interested. Would you mind stopping by and can we have a conversation? Yes, sir. I don't have a problem talking to you about it. Well, how's it going? Well, sir, to tell you the truth, it sucks. What? Yeah. Now, my assumption is we've got into mental health, everything's good, right? But if you understand, have a little bit deeper understanding, you have these more mature discussions. And so to me, that's what it's now moving to, is this, you know, this progressive broadening and deeper understanding of how do you do this in terms of leadership and how do you relate to the medical community and all that. And so I think the day is coming. I hope it is. So,
Can I make a statement on the medical part?
Tim.
Yeah. On the medical piece, it's been my experience, and Tim talked about this too, is that A, the pills don't really work, and B,
right,
if you do get therapy, they're going to, in therapy, try to convince you that whatever it is that's causing your problem isn't all your fault, which is not bad per se. But when you start parsing together and starting to excuse behavior as an adult, probably because of something you don't remember happening in your childhood, that does not land with a thud to me. And then explain that the fix is to get your neurochemicals all evened out, because no doubt you got a neurochemical deficit because of something that you can't relate or remember. No. That is why it's a failure in such a high percentage. The drugs don't necessarily work, and sometimes some of these people, and I would include me in that, need to be told the exact fucking truth. It's your fault. You're a fucking asshole. What do you expect to happen to you? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but we don't need to call you an asshole. I mean, we could just...
No, no, I'm being a little bit hard on myself, but... Right.
We could just say
You know, I'm just trying to use that as a point.
We could try. We could kind of say something like, there's room for improvement. then later, later like on...
The medical stuff in the blame shifting to traumatic events from early childhood that's not remembered, I don't think those are viable paths. I don't think it's viable treatment.
No. I think, anyway, at least for our culture, I, what resonates is when you look at somebody tell and you tell them the truth, they know you're not bullshitting. And our culture is a little bit rough and tumble, for those of you who don't know. We don't tend to sugarcoat shit. And it's the beauty of... You know, our gunnery sergeant dominated organizations. That it's that rough shit. Hey, I can fix a lot of shit. I can't fix stupid. Okay, and all those things you hear, you know, as growing up in the Marine Corps, and they're ultimately true. And it's this rough and tumble honesty that I think people find refreshing. And I think that, I don't. I've never heard anybody talk about these things like we talk about them. Which is kind of cool. Will, you were going to say something.
Yeah. So when I was a weapons training battalion in Quantico, almost everyone in that battalion, and so almost all of them were veterans. Because I was there in 2008, combat veterans.
Right.
2008. So these guys were Iraq guys from 6, 7, and 8, and we had a certain degree of interaction with mental health. And the thing that bothered me. That I didn't back down on was the command was not part of the solution. And I told the mental health people that there is no solution without the CO being involved. And a guy got after me about, well, you know, this isn't just, you know, you need to be informed. I said, no, I need to be part of the solution. I'm actually with that guy 12 hours a day. And for the ones that live in the barracks, 24. And, you know, we were in a transition. Wounded Warrior was online. We were getting more honest about mental health issues. But that Chinese wall that people wanted to put up that was so unnatural to me, and I figured out after a little while that I was really an outlier in that, and that a lot of people were perfectly happy to turn their mental health problems over to the mental health people, ship them off to Wounded Warrior Regiment, and off you go. You know, the great thing for me is I was a battalion commander with a sergeant major in a battalion of about 250 people. So I had plenty of time to devote to every individual case if I wanted to. I don't know where we are in the Marine Corps today, but the idea that there's some sort of patient privacy right that information is kept from a CO means that we will fail in every case. And that what it should be is the CO is the first point of contact to help ensure that we're going to find the right way to help someone in the command out, because that's what it's about. And that COs ought to be evaluated on that. That's part of your job, is actually taking care of these people. And not sending them off or relying on someone else. You marshal the mental health people to assist you, not to push a problem to. So I don't know where we are.
Well, what's interesting, I was talking to Dave Furness when he was CG of 2nd Division. And when they would have a suicide, I mean, he would get everybody around the table. Right? What happened? And he said, you know, sometimes it got uncomfortable. But if we don't sit down and look at these events and say, what could we have done better? And you know, the 8-day reports and all this that happened, you know, but what opportunities did we have? And I'll give you some. And this is just in the last 90 days. And they're anecdotes from both coasts. You know, commands say, don't release him. He needs to be under somebody's supervision. And the medical people, oh no, he's fine. One staff sergeant shoots himself in the head after being released in spite of what the command said. and then another, a sergeant, gets released and hangs himself. And so, to testament to what Will's saying, I mean, the command doesn't have a vote. And the command's hands are tied, because if the medical people say this, then you don't say, okay, well, look, I disagree, and I'm the commanding officer, so boom. You don't have that authority, evidently. And so it's frustrating, because and here's the other part of it. There's a cultural piece. The people that are therapists and the mental health people tended not to hang out with people like us. All right? They come from a different tribe. Now, some are veterans, but the vast majority are not. And they see themselves as a safe harbor of these Marines that are going, and sailors that are going to see them. And they don't want to tell us, because there's a fear that, oh, there'll be retribution against this guy. Well, you don't get it. They don't get the whole culture, which is we love them. And if the best thing for this Marine or sailor is to be home with their parents, then guess what? That's where they need to be. Because unless you can tell me the path to deployability for this kid, then there's no point in this. They need to go home and be in the loving care of their family. That's the best place. But the kid says, well, I don't want to get out of the Marine Corps. It doesn't matter what they say. And I'll tell you what, and this is a painful one for me, because this is when I first became sensitized to it. When I was the OPSO at MEF headquarters group, kid has suicidal ideations and homicidal ideations, right? Leaves therapy, comes back to work, has a pistol in his pocket. Walk up, his buddies are on a smoke break, they're smoking, blah, 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 and they're like, hey, we got to go back into the shop. And they head back in, and he says, I'm just going to finish this cigarette, I'll be right in. And finishes a cigarette, throws it away, pulls a pistol out, kills himself. Now, he had both suicidally and homicidally ideated. And the therapist is bound, duty-bound, to call the commanding officer. Didn't do it. And as a result, somebody's dead. And that's the fight, you know, as Will said. And that's, to me, the thing about post-traumatic winning. If you think Mother Marine Corps is going to come down and fix this, it ain't happening. It's individual Marines helping individual Marines, helping other people. And most of the time, in my opinion, these people don't need a therapist. But they do need somebody to talk to, somebody that will understand, somebody that will go there with them. Now, there's a fraction of people that do need therapists. But not every. Most people just need to fucking talk about it. I mean, for me, I mean, this is my therapy. These guys are my therapists, along with a bunch of other guys that I have these conversations with. And that's what the vast majority of us need. And yet, it's such a frustrating fight, as Will's kind of alluding to.
And they don't need the constant shoving of dope at them either.
Oh, my God. No, they don't. They absolutely don't. And I mean, I haven't met anybody, right, anybody who says, other than, you know, an initial when I was really struggling, you know, it kind of calmed me down. It helped me sleep. And then I got off them. And so they were a bridge to me to a better place for a short period of time. I've heard that before.
Yeah.
But in most the course of action that most guys take is they take them and then they throw them away. They just stop taking them. And again, you and my friend Tim that was on yesterday, I mean, he talked about it. He said, yeah, I threw the drugs away. I hated it. But I continue to self-medicate with alcohol.
Yeah.
And so I fulfilled the function, because I couldn't, you know, I couldn't, I didn't know how to live with this shit. I didn't know how to live with this shit.
You know, I got to tell you guys, I'm going through something right now. I don't want to talk about it, because there's the guy who I'm working with, it's one of my kids. I got 5 stepsons and 3 sons. And it's one of them, and I don't want to get any more specific about it, but I'm going through this right now at the VA and the medication thing. And it's related to seizures, but it's the same type of thing in that, it's a battle, you know, and, the attitude of the like mental health professionals for sure is, like you were saying, Mac, they want to extrapolate the thing, like from the time a guy was born until now, so they can get away from the military aspect of the thing, and also from the history of their prescribing medications to it too. You know, they are like you say, it's a different tribe, and it's very difficult. It's very difficult to crack through it and get effective care. You know, there's so much ass covering and shit like that that it's just it's a real battle.
Right. Right. All right. Any other thoughts on this subject before we talk about what you're reading? I got a couple emails about what you're reading too. Amazing. They're like, "Hey, keep doing what you're reading, because I wind up reading all this a lot of these things." Right? I just got an email. "I'm a lawyer from a family of yours who died and left his inheritance to you in the bank. Please contact me." How, my lucky day today, boys. All right.
Yeah. Won the lottery.
Will, what are you reading there, bud?
I am reading a book called American Moonshot by Douglas Brinkley. One of the things I like to read is just about the whole U.S. space program and Apollo. And this book is a little bit different, and then it tracks the rise of John F. Kennedy. Talks about Wernher von Braun was a Nazi, you know, rocketeer who basically built the Saturn V. But I like to think I know the history of the space program reasonably well. But this is an interesting sort of take on it, because it shows the politics between Kennedy Nixon, Kennedy Johnson, and just the whole Cold War, and how that combined with von Braun's real genius to the moon. And if it wouldn't have been for that connection in the late 50s and early 60s, it's probably unlikely that we would have gone to the moon, maybe at all. So it's an interesting book. It's been out a couple of years. I picked it up used a couple of weeks ago. American Moonshot by Douglas Brinkley.
American Moonshot. Wow. Are you kind of a astronaut dork?
No, it's funny. I don't know how I got onto this stuff, but I've read, I would say, most of the books by the astronauts. And the thing is, I think they're impressive to me in a different way than maybe maybe they were in popular culture. When you get into these guys, you know, they were genuinely giants.
Yeah.
You think maybe they're just sort of playing. But, you know, Neil Armstrong may have been one of the all-time greatest pilots in the history of the world. And it's a little bit serendipitous, but it's a whole lot of work and genius and brain and everything else that put him in Apollo 11 at that time. So I do find that whole program sort of...
Got it. All right.
Yeah, those online casinos, they take up a lot of bandwidth, man.
All right, Timmy, what are you reading?
Okay, I mentioned last week that I was going to read The Pacific Crucible, which is the Ian W. Toll's first book of his trilogy on the naval campaign in the Pacific, and it remarked how it's very, very strange how him and Hornsfisher are both so young in age and what have you. And I remarked, I said, I wonder if they knew each other. Well, I finished this thing because I couldn't put it down, and it dovetails with Neptune's Inferno perfectly. It stops at the very beginning of the Guadalcanal campaign, and I wouldn't be surprised if his next one kind of dovetails with Hornsfisher too, because they write almost identical. And as I was reading this book, and I just picked up so much I didn't know, I identified somebody who got trashed at the time, who's been, I think, redeemed in history, but that was Commander Rochefort, the code-breaking guy. Yeah, who was an Academy grad. All he wanted to do was be out at sea. He had served a term in Japanese, knew Japanese, was not a communications guy, but Nimitz had put him there because he trusted him, and the communications department of the Navy, which was headed by two brothers, or the Redmond brothers. One was an admiral, one a captain, both Academy guys and communication officers. At the beginning of the war, they made – Pearl Harbor subordinate to them, and Rochefort ignored them. And Rochefort kept on telling Nimitz, they're full of shit, because King is bugging them, saying they're going to hit up Panama Canal. They're going to hit the West Coast. My guys are telling me that this is where they're going to be. And Rochefort's going, no, 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 they're going south. And so it got so bad that Nimitz demanded that King come to San Francisco and let Rochefort explain to him what he's doing. And then King goes, all right. So after Midway happens, the Redmond brothers conspire to trash Rochefort. They leak a story to the Chicago Tribune claiming credit for being the code breakers. And their story is that we had to pull the Pearl Harbor team out of the fire because it's being run by an ex-Japanese language student who's not a professional. And not only did they award themselves Distinguished Service Crosses, they took Rochefort's and they put him in some goddamn stateside billet for the rest of his career. And that was it. And Rochefort, to his dying day, never would talk about it with the historians, because there's a lot of people were looking for it. He was voted the most valuable, the MVP of World War II at some Pacific Gamers Roundtable in 2000. I mean, his story is now out. But talk about getting burned, and he couldn't do anything about it because it was all classified and nobody could know. God damn, man. That's just one of those stories I had to share of that's getting a stick, man. But anyway, I'm reading End of October that Will recommended, and it irks the shit out of me because it's a book written by elites targeting elites flying in airplanes. I'm sure it's a fast pacer, but it doesn't talk about politics, but you can tell from the way that he talks about it. Every Democrat mayor and these guys, they stand up. They're so forward. They go down fighting. The disease gets them. It's 180 out from what's actually happened during our pandemic. And I can't get past that. I'm a small-minded man. It's ruining the enjoyment of the whole damn thing. The hero himself is some sort of a crippled Fauci, because he can't be a Fauci. He could be a short guy, but if he's just a heterosexual white guy, then I can't have that. So he's got some kind of a rickets or some shit. So he walks around with a cane that he sacrifices to the cause. It's beginning to irritate me, but man, it's exciting. it is cool reading about how everybody's just going to hell in a handbasket. I just can't get past the politics that aren't even there. That's it.
Got it. Jeff, what are you reading?
So here's what happened. I'm reading the book that Will recommended about the Holocaust, which is good. Moving on into the Soviet Union and stuff. And also I'm reading Neptune's Inferno. So reading Neptune's Inferno, I'm thinking it's a motivating book. There's, you know, and very interesting, of course, about the Guadalcanal battles regarding the Navy, more the naval part of it. So I'm going through YouTube, and I stumble on the Sand Pebbles. And it's the scene where the captain of the gunboat, played by Richard Crenna, is talking to, and I don't know the young actor's name. He's like the other, like the XO, the only other officer on the boat, Mr. Bordalis. And it's like they've gone through all this stress where the men have been heckled, and they've been had demonstrations against them. It's in the late 20s in China. And he says to him this, he says, the men are under tremendous stress right now. You know, we can't let them off. We can't let them go for liberty, only for missions that go ashore to support the legation that's there. And, so I want you to, we need to protect the men. And then he pauses and he looks him in the eye and he goes, so stay clear of them. And I thought to myself, that is so compelling. That is a form of leadership in dark times. That, in other words, you know that stuff might happen that your duty bound reaction to is out of proportion to the situation that the men are going through at that point. And so he says to the guy, "So stay away from him." So you don't see it. You know, you don't see the minor transgression that your rocks and shoals discipline you put up against, you know, will have an effect that's not just. And that's a subtle concept. So I started reading Sand Pebbles again by McKenna. You know, it's a great book. And that's what I'm reading. And that's why.
There you have it. Quality work today, boys. Congratulations. I enjoy this immensely. Yeah, and I'll tell you what, one of the things I enjoy the most about this still is this is the same shit we've been doing for forever.
30 some years.
Yeah. And it's on different subjects and things like that. But this intellectual, I don't know what you would call it, thing that we do that so I find deeply thought-provoking is one of the highlights of the week. So thank you guys very much. Have a great weekend, and we will talk.
All right, brother, out here. Thanks again, Mac.
All right, see you, Timmy.
Take it easy out here.
Right. See you. See you, Will. That is those are the Mensa brothers. Yeah. The I've got a couple emails about the Mensa brothers. One, Mensa brothers are really good today. Their honesty is to be commended. You know about the Mensa brothers, they're great guys, period. And you get a sense of it, but if you know them and you know the kind of people they are, pretty cool. And like I said, it's really cool to be doing this with them, 30 years later. So awesome. Great stuff. If you're just tuning in, I talk about kind of, I tease my thoughts on guilt relative to trauma and shame relative to trauma, which I consider very different things. And and I'll expand on that. To me, shame is probably you're the victim, but it's not. My trauma wasn't in combat or something like that. It was something that I wouldn't feel comfortable talking to people about, you know? And then guilt is I had something to do with the event that happened in terms of being responsible for it. And I don't want to talk about that in front of anybody. So, so I think as you kind of consider this stuff, a more mature understanding of what it is to the different on-ramps that people have to get on in order to get to post-traumatic winning. And those are different on-ramps, right? And then a lot of times they're on-ramps that people don't want to take. So anyway, with that, don't be afraid to get out there and change somebody's life. It's important stuff and life-changing stuff. And you can do it, trust me. So on this Thursday, have a great day. Mike McNamara, out.